He's got a beautiful backswing.
Dad, oh, he got all of that one.
Oh my gosh.
That is amazing.
Layup with an iron into the hazard.
Well, that wasn't quite what I meant, you know.
Welcome in, everybody, to another edition of the 73rd Hole. Colby Powell, Taylor Williams with you as always. Find us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Search 73rd Hole. You will find us. The best place to find the links to these podcasts as soon as we put them out every Monday and Wednesday during the season. Of course, we had a long off season where we had some great interviews with some great guests. We're actually trying to get a couple more good interviews set up in the coming weeks, so stay tuned for that. Find us on social media and rate this podcast wherever you are listening. Rate and subscribe, Apple, Spotify, Google, wherever you're listening. Go ahead and rate 5 stars and give us a quick subscribe to make sure that you are getting these coming your way as they are released. 5 stars, Taylor, to John Rahm for his performance this weekend at Muirfield Village. It was crazy. Going into the back nine on Saturday, he was the chaser. And then about the same time, about 18 holes later in the tournament on Sunday, he's just posted up with an 8-shot lead waiting for the weather to pass. It was a pretty dominating performance from essentially the middle of the front nine on Saturday through the turn on Sunday.
Yeah, and he mentioned that after his round on Saturday, saying it was one of the best rounds he felt like he ever played, and there was a lot of stuff that went around on social media talking about how, well, I can't remember the exact quote, where a scramble team of 4 scratch golfers couldn't break par, and a regular scratch player couldn't break 90. It was something along those lines.
Yeah, he said your scratch club champion couldn't have broken 90 on Saturday, and he said that he doesn't know if 4 scratch club champions scrambling could have broken par. I think 4 scratch club champions scrambling probably break par.
You think so? The reason is because, you know, generally you have 4 shots, so you're not making any bogeys.
Right.
Or you wouldn't make a lot of bogeys. Maybe one if on a par 3 or something that's over 200 yards.
Or on a short par 3 like 16 where you can't hit the green.
Correct, yeah, and where Phil's laying up on it.
How wild was that?
So it was on 13. So in his last 6 holes, he putts from 80 yards out and then lays up on 170-yard par 3.
Did you hear his rationale for putting, though, after the round on 13?
I heard his rationale for laying up. What was his rationale for putting?
So on 13, he had 78 yards in, but that pin's over on kind of like the back left, just over the bunker. So he said with the greens being so firm, he didn't think that the wedge would hold, but the green is actually pitched more severely right to left. Pardon me, the fairway is pitched more severely right to left, right in front of the hole. So he thought that if he putted, if he would have hit it hard enough, he could have gotten it to kind of be curling around the bunker on the ground, because that slope in front of the green would have moved it so hard to the left that that would have been the way to get it closest to the hole. He just said, you know, I didn't execute, didn't hit it hard enough. And then, you know, he hits a mega flop from 34 yards to about 3 feet and makes par anyway. It was very Phil. The whole back nine was very Phil Mickelson.
That was very classic Phil, that flop shot for sure, because that thing went about as high as an Empire State Building and landed up there and rolled out to 3 feet. And I thought it was interesting how Finau down on the back nine, obviously he wasn't really in it as much. It was just Rahm had that 8-shot lead, and there for a little bit it looked like Palmer would have had a chance because Rahm was kind of faltering down the stretch.
Palmer was 3 down with 3 to play, which is exactly what Morikawa was last week when he came back and beat JT. So certainly had my attention.
It had your attention, absolutely. And you know, going back to the Finau thing, Finau had a similar shot to what Phil did, but after the rain delay, which was about 50 minutes or so, he was able to hit a wedge that landed up there and spun and stopped somewhat close to the hole, while the guys beforehand you were watching, they would land it where Finau didn't. It would kick to the back of the green. There was just no way to hold it. And you saw that with a lot of greens out there, and that's why it played so tough. And the reason they were doing all this, they even showed it. Once the players got to the back nine, they were stripping up the greens on the front nine. I think it was the 6th hole that they showed.
That was the one with the picture is like half dug up already.
Yeah, they already had all the turf, and they were asking if they could buy some turf, donate it to charity. So, I mean, they had talked about
they
how...
They donated it to me.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, you could use it, right? And so I just thought it was interesting how they kept talking about how, you know, that's the reason this course is getting burned up, how it's playing so tough. And they definitely didn't wait for everyone to get off the course. They just said, we're starting as soon as we can. And I thought it was pretty cool to see that. And at the same time, it was cool to see how even the wind did pick up. It kind of died down a little bit after the storm had come through.
Right after the storm, it was like gale force. But about a half hour after the storm passed, it got back to 10 to 15.
Yeah, so essentially what the leaders had probably their last six holes or so was probably somewhat close to that. They didn't have a whole lot of wind to play with. Something like that, maybe a little less. But as you've seen, the course just played so tough. There was the pin sheet that went around for Sunday, how there was what was there. There was only two pins that were more than five paces off of one of the edges. I mean, just crazy stuff. And for some guys like Matthew Fitzpatrick to shoot 68, that's damn good playing.
Well, it's all that experience he had on the bag.
Yeah, exactly. Bones McKay had seen it a time or
two.
Yeah,
he had Bones on the bag steering him all the way around. I don't know how many places he moved up, because I don't know where he was through three rounds, but Matthew Fitzpatrick...
He moved at 15 spots is what it says on... looking at the PGA Tour leaderboard.
So he ends up finishing solo third, which is really impressive. He actually didn't move up as many spots. The biggest mover yesterday was Xander Schauffele, and he only shot a 270 compared to Fitzpatrick's 468, but because Schauffele was a little bit further down, he hopped so many more people. So Schauffele, who you picked in our big season-long one and done pool, shoots 78 on Thursday. Everybody assumes that he's going to miss the cut and be out of the tournament. Shoots 69 on Friday to make the cut on the number. Goes 72-70 on the weekend. 5 under the final 3 days for Xander Schauffele. He was really impressive after the opening 78. But, man, the scores were tough. Patrick Reed gets off to a great start yesterday. Made some bombs early is what happened. Plays his last four holes in 4 over par. Tony Finau, like you said, where did he even finish?
Finau has finished solo eighth at -2. So he was 11 under, right? Whenever he had the 3-shot lead, or was he 12 under?
So he was 11 or 12 on Saturday with a 3-shot lead.
So essentially on his last 26 holes, he played him about 9 over.
Yeah, sounds about right. I mean, he was definitely moving the wrong direction. One guy that we were both on the fade train this week because we had not seen him play back-to-back weeks of good golf. Well, really 1 week of good golf, much less back-to-back after the T7 last week at Workday, was Jason Day. And he comes out, his worst score of the four rounds was 73. Pretty good in the conditions that were played. It was better than Rahm, better than Ryan Palmer, better than Matthew Fitzpatrick, all these guys. So he finishes 4 under in a T4 with my close personal friend Matt Wallace. So Jason Day, back-to-back top 10s, a top 5 in U.S. Open-like conditions. Maybe a little return to form for Jason Day. You can tell he's still a little stiff, though.
That back, especially those last 2 days, was not looking good for him. We noticed it, too, with Tiger on Friday, how his back looked tight, and we were curious as to if he was even going to be able to get through it, and we'll get on to Tiger on a little bit. But for Day, he's such a hit-or-miss guy. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if he comes out and wins another tournament, wins a major. It's just I don't think that he's going to be able to keep longevity up. That back just – I mean, as you saw, he can't even bend down to pick up a tee or get a ball out of the hole the right way. Yeah.
How long do you realistically think Jason Day can practice putt before he has to call it?
I don't think he can hardly at all. And then, so, I mean, he's going to get to a point where he goes out there and plays by feel and with no practice. And then, you know, he's still so naturally talented that he can contend in some events. But it's that back is so injuries can plague this game just like they can any sport, and hopefully he can be able to get something to where he can figure it out long term. But from what I saw those last 2 days, it looked like he was just piecing it together so he could finish the tournament. I mean, if his back was like that on Thursday, I don't think there's any way he would have finished the tournament.
Yeah, it was getting better as we worked our way toward the end. This 73rd hole, Colby Powell and Taylor Williams, Bushwood Golf and Country Club. Get down to Chickasha right now. Make your tee time 404, 405, 224, 1250. Next couple days, highs like 89, 90 degrees, 10-mile-an-hour wind. Great time to play some golf down at Bushwood. If you did not get signed up for the four-person scramble on Friday night, 9 holes in the light, 9 holes in the dark, it's a little too late. The field has filled up. I will be playing in that tournament, playing with my wife, my sister, and my brother-in-law. So should be a lot of fun. Be a lot of fun for the girls if they don't get it too far off the tee. They can ride up with us to the bombs that me and the brother-in-law will be hitting. Brother-in-law's like 6'5", 3'10", and played golf growing up. He can hit it when he gets a hold of it.
Yeah, you need to get him a long drive driver and just get it to where he tees it high, lets it fly, and just sends that baby about as far as he can. And then if you're playing night golf, you're using those balls, they're going to fly just a little shorter, but it's going to be so much fun just because it's something that, you know, you hardly ever do. I mean, I've played in one night golf tournament my entire life, and there's a lot of people that never have. And it's something that's really fun, and you'll enjoy it for sure. And those people that didn't get down and get signed up in time, they will regret it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then next week got a little youth clinic going on that you're helping with.
Yeah, junior camp. Yep, I'll be one of the instructors helping down there. So definitely call down and get your junior signed up if you want them to learn some tools of the trade, as they say. We'll have a good full 5 days of fun, and you know, get out there and get their games get up there where we need to be and help grow the game, which is what I and the 73rd hole are all about, and making sure this game grows and as many people love it as much, or at least as close to what we can.
Yeah, exactly. I offered to help with the junior camp, but they said that wasn't the exact kind of swing instruction they were looking for. So
you could talk to them about what not to do.
Exactly.
Or, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, just go up there and stand out of bounds. Don't hit it here. Yeah. That's my advice.
But this is your A flight Washita Valley champion we are talking to here. Let's just say that.
You signed up for B.
Let me say that.
Oh, I've never won B flight. I played the Valley 6 times in B flight, never won it. So me winning A flight, maybe a little bit of an outlier.
Sandbagger.
Anyway, so I do want to ask, though. So here's what we need to tell the kids not to do. Don't ground your club behind the ball in the rough, causing it to slightly oscillate if you are in contention on Sunday with a close-up high-definition camera on your golf ball. Because if that happens, you will be assessed a two-shot penalty. Luckily, Taylor, this did not impact the outcome of the tournament, because that would have been a disastrous way for this tournament to have been decided. Still, it just kind of sucks that Rom played so great, and that a huge talking point is going to be the fact that that ball moved, I mean, just minutely on number 16.
Well, and there's a couple things I want to get to about this, because it really frustrates me. One thing I want to mention that isn't even really golf related is, and you might know this because you're a betting connoisseur, I would assume the over and under for the winning par in Vegas was close to anywhere between 9.5 and 10.5.
Gosh, I wish I would have looked. I don't even know how to go back and find it. I really wish I would have looked.
Because that was one thing we talked about early in the week, was is single digits or double digits going to win this tournament? That was kind of the main point. All of a sudden, you're 11 under. You drop it down to 9 under. That could have had betting implications somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and that's something I thought about right afterwards. But going back onto this, for me, when I saw it, what it looked like to me was that the ball was sitting up on some, it was sitting down a little bit in the grass, but yet it was sitting up because the rough's so long, you know, so it's sitting up on some. And it looked like to me, when he set the club down behind the ball, it's not that the ball moved, it's that the grass below the ball is what's moved. So
yeah, the club was actually like 3 inches away from the ball. He was just, I think, setting his club down to kind of get a feel of the grass.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what it was doing. So you see the ball, and think of it as, I mean, you know, just sitting on a brush or something, and all of a sudden the bristles move, so the ball doesn't necessarily move. That's why it changed its angle, but it's because the grass laid over. And, I mean, there's a couple of different things about this. One is that I would guarantee you, if you had a close-up camera on every single shot this week, there would be at least 50 times, and I would say
I was going to say 100,
maybe 100, where the ball
as thick as that rough was. That happened 100 times this week.
I bet there's probably 100 times that happened, that exact same amount. But I bet there's at least 50 times where the ball moved more than that in that thick rough, because
guys are trying to do it. As a golfer, what do you do whenever you get in and you're getting set for a shot?
Yeah.
You put your club behind the ball, and with the way the rough was grown this week, that's going to happen. It's going to happen, but if you're not in contention on Sunday, it's not a penalty. If you're in contention on Sunday, you've got a high-def camera 10 feet behind you on your golf ball, it's a penalty.
And that's what they tried to change the rule about, the limitation of use of video evidence in the USGA Rulebook's rule 34-3/10 is limitations on use of video evidence. And from the way the rule reads, it says that really the only two exceptions to this where they can be able to use some technology is when the player unknowingly touches a few grains of sand in the backswing with the club on a stroke from a bunker, or when a player is unaware that a club struck the ball more than once in the course of making a single stroke. And that does not apply to this situation. And I don't see how, with a naked eye, that even standing over that ball like Rom was, because Ian Baker Fitch on the telecast made a good point where a lot of times when you're in the rough, you know, you're looking at the target to try to pick either your landing spot or where you want the ball to end up, or the target like he was doing. And another thing I want to bring back onto the Rom chip is that once they showed it behind and the backwards behind the ball when he chipped, you saw how much break he had to play on that short little chip.
Yes.
It goes to show how much that green slopes. And so like a shot like Tiger in 2012, okay, kind of goes to show how much greater that is, and even how good of a shot Rom hit yesterday. Just it just wanted to show how much that green slope.
Yeah, because the camera angle from off the back of the green did not do the amount of slope that it had justice.
No, and it never has. It never does. And so you get to see, I mean, he had about, 10 feet of green to work with, and he played 3 feet of break, if not more.
It was on either three or four paces there. So, that would have been somewhere in the 9 to 12 foot range, probably.
Yeah, and then played, and that thing broke at least two feet, probably closer to three feet.
Flopped it out, got it to land just dead soft, on the fringe, by the way, roll up, and then just die right in on the right side. I mean, it was a phenomenal golf shot, and I take nothing away from it, from the fact that whenever you zoom in slow motion with a high-definition camera, we can see the ball oscillate one dimple to the left. That takes nothing away from it for me.
And so the two main sticking points out from this, which is just ridiculous, one is that we kind of already reiterated to it, but this is happening so many times in the course of the tournament. There's no way this is the only time this happened. And so for it to be penalized to the leader of the tournament after a great shot is just criminal. And then the opposite side of that is, why does it, if it is a penalty at all, which it shouldn't be, my feeling on the rule is that a ball should have to move at least two or three times that much for it to even be cause a penalty, because obviously the ball did not improve its lie at all. So there's no benefit to it. And then the next point is, if you are going to penalize it, why the hell does it have to be two strokes? Why is it two strokes? Why is it not just one? Why does it have to be two? That's like in football, if you have 12 men on the field, it's a 30-yard penalty. I mean, like, why? It makes no freaking sense.
Yeah.
It's just stupid. It's way too much of a penalty for something that doesn't give you benefit.
Yeah, I mean, if he would have had a one-shot lead at the time, all of a sudden he's now one back going into 17, as opposed to if it's a one-shot penalty, he'd still be tied. But here's what I don't like. So golf as a game, right? It's all about integrity. It's about calling penalties on yourself. It's about if your ball moved, you know that your ball moved. And again, this goes back to the problem of this happening constantly throughout the week, and we can't see it because we don't have cameras in all those spots. But if you're in contention on Sunday, you get screwed. If you're the leader, you get screwed because there's a camera right on it. Golf's a game of integrity, right? Why are we using video at all to determine penalties? Why are there exceptions where we're using video to determine penalties? Golf is the gentleman's game where you call penalties on yourself. The onus is on the player if he thinks that his ball moved to call a penalty on himself. And if he doesn't, then there's no penalty. That's how I think it should be. That's, you know, me and you playing in the Wichita Valley, that's how it would be. If I played a tournament this Saturday at the Greens, that's how it would be. You know, you go play with your buddies, that's how it is. Why are we using high-definition slow-motion video to determine penalties in what is the gentleman's game? And it's always been, you know, if your ball moves, you call a penalty on yourself. And then all of a sudden, on Sunday, if you're in contention, and one thing we never got yesterday, they never showed us a wide camera angle that showed where John Rahm was looking while the ball moved, because he could have been putting his club down to feel the grass, and he could have been looking at the hole.
That's exactly what he was doing, I believe.
And I'm sure he was. I doubt that he ever saw it or noticed it. And I just, man, two shots there is so, so severe of a penalty for something that he didn't mean to do, something he probably didn't even see happen. What? Stop using video to assess penalties. That's my opinion. Stop altogether. Altogether, we need to be done using video to assess penalties.
This is where, if you are going to use video to assess penalties, this is how it has to change. This goes back to one of our biggest talking points about golf is golf coverage. So we don't have golf coverage on every single group on Thursday and Friday, and Saturday and even early Sunday. So those guys that play who don't have a camera on them, their ball can do that, and they'll get away with it just fine. And they could even know about it. And, you know, and if they don't have integrity, they don't say anything. So if you want
Patrick Reed played by himself on Saturday.
Oh, boy. God, yeah, you better send a rules official out there to follow that man. So my point being is that if you want to use video evidence to call penalties on players, have a camera with every group so that we can watch it. And if we can watch every single shot and of every single player, like we should be able to, like you and me talk about how many ever times on this show, then you can are able to use video to assess penalties.
But, and if we can't, then it's not fair to the guys who are in contention on Sunday.
It is not. And then even at the same time, too, even if there are penalties that need to be assessed, if someone gets caught cheating, they don't need to be assessed a two-shot penalty. They need to be suspended from the tour, if not kicked off.
If they're if they're intentionally cheating.
Yes.
Yeah. Not what Rahm did yesterday.
Yeah.
We're talking intentional cheating, like what we all believe that Patrick Reed did at the Hero.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, or
two very different things.
Or, you know, maybe a situation where if you're in, like, you're hitting a fairway wood out of rough and the guy's looking at the ball and clearly, you know, like from a wide, you know, wide camera view, you can see the ball sit down in the rough and then he lies about it, you know, then there's other ways around it where you could, if you know that a player is, you know, knowingly committing rule, there's the, you know, Adam Hadwin thing a few weeks ago where he picked up what he thought was a rock and was a sand and pebble and called the penalty on himself. So that's what golf's about. And
again, gentleman's game. We didn't need a high definition camera for that. That's what golf's all about.
That's what it's supposed to be about. And we know so many great people in this game who wouldn't do anything like that. But you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars in FedEx points and everything for just strokes. I mean, you can't tell me there's not a couple guys out there who haven't done something like that, where they've seen a ball and not called it. I mean, I'm not saying anyone I know that has done that or anyone that would do that besides Patrick Reed, who's notorious for it. But to have it on the leaders and to have a camera do something like that to where something that's not visible, and then even below it for the rules for it to be a two-stroke penalty, it's just a joke for the rules of golf. And some of the rules that they changed a couple years ago were beneficial to the game. Some weren't. But there needs to be a much bigger overhaul in the rules than we had a couple years ago.
Yeah, at least they did away with the call-ins, because, again, that was a situation where, like Tiger, every single shot is televised from multiple angles, multiple replays available. And people were calling in on, like, the most minute little stuff with Tiger. And it's like, that's a terrible, terrible rule. Well, you've got one guy who all 200 and however many 280 shots are being shown for 4 days. And then you've got another 155 guys in the field who you're seeing maybe a handful of their shots the entire week. Well, nobody's calling in on golf shots they can't see, but it's just...
One thing I wonder is, because they've stopped the call-ins for sure, but I wonder if... Because more than call-ins anymore would be social media. So I wonder if the PGA Tour has someone, you know, essentially scouting, you know, hashtag Memorial or hashtag PGA Tour, and then someone on there who bet Ryan Palmer on Sunday is, you know, complaining about Rahm's ball move. So then all of a sudden they look at it and they're like, oh, man, oh, yeah, it did move. Because it was... What it was probably, they were on 17 fairway or walking up to 17 green whenever they started talking about it. So at what point did they notice or realize that the ball moved? Who was the first one to notice that the ball isolated and moved is what I want to know.
Because, yeah, that's a good question.
Because at no point watching, when I watched it, did it look like it moved. I mean,
I didn't notice it live. I didn't notice until they went back on the replay.
No, I don't think there would have been any way to. And I don't think even Rahm standing over the ball looking at it could have noticed it move. Because... like I said, to me, it looked like the grass is what moved the ball, which would technically mean that the ball didn't move, that what was under it was moved, which I technically moved. But nevertheless, there needs to be an overhaul in the rules of golf. And for my opinion, I think that if you do not deem, even if you cause the ball to move for whatever reason, if you're not making a stroke, there needs to be a set mark on how far that ball moves before it counts against you, because it's a little ridiculous.
Yeah, I think that we need to, in the game of golf, define the difference between a ball moving and a ball oscillating. Because what Rahm's ball did, it just kind of oscillated. It just kind of settled it. It like rotated one dimple to the left. That's different than if you put your club behind the ball and it rolls 3 inches back down the hill. It's a very different thing. And the penalty for those two things, I don't think should be the same, because it's a much different action. It's a much different outcome. I just, again, the two-shot penalty for a ball oscillating one dimple to the left, because you put his club in the ground like 3 inches behind the ball on that particular time. The grass laid over, the ball oscillated a dimple, he's penalized two shots.
And so I wonder if Ryan Palmer or someone else up there, if they were 9 or 10 under, I wonder if the ruling would have been different. I bet it would have been. I don't think there's any way they would have penalized him.
Boy, can you imagine?
I don't think there's any way they could have done that.
Can you imagine the shit storm the PGA Tour would have found in themselves if that would have cost Ryan Palmer the tournament? Oh.
Yeah, I mean, oh. It would have been one hell of a dumpster fire. Luckily, Rahm, I'm saying he won by five. He technically won by three. Just dominated. Like we talked earlier in the week, how in the world is the number two player in the world 22-1 to bet on at 92 or 9,300 on DraftKings? So we loaded up on him there. But at the same time, the rules of golf, they piss me off sometimes, man. Yep. That's just ridiculous. For it to be a two-shot penalty and then for them to... Like I said, I want to know who was the first one who noticed it and how it got figured out, because because without high definition camera, I don't know how you noticed that ball didn't move. And as we clearly see, rule 34-3/10, look it up. Everyone can go out there and look it up. Video evidence should not be used on a situation like this.
Yep. I didn't think he was going to be penalized. I was actually talking about it in my big group text. Some people thought that he was going to be penalized. He does end up getting a two-stroke penalty, still wins the tournament officially by 3 shots. So John Rahm moves to number one in the world at 25 years old. We need to take a quick break. We're going to come back on the other side. We still have so much to get to. We have not yet gotten into the week. Pardon me, of Tiger Woods. We've got to talk about that. We talked a little bit about Phil. That was not the only rules discrepancy that took place this week at the event. Bryson, in the middle of his 10 cup moment, got in quite the heated debate with some rules officials. So we'll get into all that, recap our picks, much, much more as we recap the Memorial Jacks Tournament, second week in a row at Muirfield Village. That's all coming up next. Stay with us here on the 73rd hole.
When something the size of a golf ball hits your roof, you need to call McRae Roofing. McRae Roofing is Oklahoma's designer roofing service specialist. For years, Jeff McRae and the experienced team at McRae Roofing and Exteriors have served fellow Oklahomans by helping them with their roofing needs. McRae Roofing uses only top quality materials and professional crews to make sure that each job is done right, so it will give you the years of service, security, and protection you need from the unpredictable Oklahoma weather. McRae Roofing offers residential and commercial roofing, ventilation services, and custom copper designs. McRae Roofing is dedicated to exceeding the homeowner's expectations. It's not just a roof, it is your home's crowning glory. Call McRae Roofing today at 405-692-4000. That's 405-692-4000. Make sure to also visit their website at mcraeroofing.com. That's M-C-R-A-Y roofing.com. Don't get caught with a leaking roof. Contact McRae Roofing for your free inspection today.
Welcome back. We're rolling along here on the 73rd hole. Colby Powell and Taylor Williams with you again. Social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, search 73rd hole. Find us. Best place to always get the first links to this podcast. We release them on Monday and Wednesday during the PGA Tour season as the schedule is in full swing. It's been a great couple weeks, Taylor. It's almost nice that we turn our mics on and talking about positive tests and negative tests has kind of become an afterthought, because it's been a few weeks since that's even been an issue. I think the Travelers was the last time that it was really an issue, whenever you had the caddies and Chase Koepka and Brooks and all those guys. So it's been nice that we haven't had to deal with that the past couple weeks. So anyway, we talked about that ruling with John Rahm on Sunday. Now let's rewind a couple days. Let's go back to Friday when Bryson is having a full-on implosion. And by the way, we're all waiting to see if Tiger's going to make the cut at plus three. Bryson's at plus one, hooks it in the creek, drops it out of bounds, drops it out of bounds, drops it, thinks it's going out of bounds, ends up staying in. So he had a little bit of a 10-cup moment there as he was trying to hit. I mean, you talk about a hero shot. He was trying to hit an insane hero shot from the left trees in thick rough with a 3-wood from 270.
With all the trouble, right, out of bounds and creek over there.
And he was having to aim over there and try to play like a 40-yard draw out of 3-4-inch thick rough. It was not a good decision by Bryson, but I want to get into his ruling, because he gets up there. First off, the first guy tells him the rule. He tells him, your ball's out of bounds. I'm really sorry. Those are the breaks. And Bryson's like, I don't believe you. I want another ruling. So second guy comes in. Bryson gets in a debate with this guy, and Bryson's kind of being a jackass, I thought. He was, he was trying to fight for what he wanted the ruling to be, but I didn't think he handled it very well. I know that you weren't watching live. We were watching it this morning before we turned our mics on. And the ball, it was only out by about a half inch. If it had moved just a little more than Rahm's ball moved on Sunday back toward the course, it would have been in, but it was under that fence. And if you draw a string from post to post on the inside of the post, no part of the golf ball would have been in bounds. So it was the correct ruling, but man, Bryson right now is so much fun to watch. But a couple weeks ago, we got him going after the cameraman for damaging his brand. And now we've got him, after he makes ill-advised decisions, hits terrible shots. First off, that ball like hit a tree in those people's backyard and kicked back toward the fence, or it wouldn't have even had a chance to be that close. Bryson, you imploded. You hit a couple bad shots. That ball's out of bounds. Don't be such a dick to the guy who's giving you the ruling just because he's the guy who's giving you the ruling. I thought Bryson was shooting the messenger a little bit on the ball being out of bounds. I was not a big fan of the way he handled it.
Yeah, and you'll see that happen whenever, because we've talked about just earlier in the show, and we have how many other times, how complex the rules in this game are and how they can be misconstrued sometimes. And, you know, obviously you don't want to have an attitude or anything like that. Bryson might have taken it a little too far. But at the same time, you know, for me, you know, as I don't know, especially since the new rule changes, I don't know the rule book, because most people rule book is, you know, they get this little bitty one and it's actually looks like about a textbook that you'd have at a university. So there's a lot of rules that go into it, which is why we need to get it back down and get a little more better for everyone. But out of bounds is very, very interesting rule, because generally, it's defined, kind of like you said, Colby, by the posts. Well, in most instances, the posts are white. So you define it by where's the white post to the next white post, draw the imaginary line, you put the string down, and there it is. But I've played in tournaments where an out of bounds can be defined as a boundary fence, where is the fence in, where's the start. And Bryson even brought it up during the argument with the rules official about Phil Mickelson at, I thought it was a different term, but it was Arnold Palmer, where he goes on the opposite side, where he's technically standing out of bounds, but he's able to hit the shot back inbounds.
Yeah, because and that was a mesh fence, which throws a whole nother quirk into the ruling, because the fence is mesh. So if the mesh fence is the divider, which in Phil's case it was, the mesh fence was the out of bounds marker, and the ball's leaning up against the mesh fence, it's still inside the mesh fence. Yeah. So it's still in play. So that even throws another wrench in the tire as we're trying to understand the rules of golf, because the mesh fence has some give to it. An iron fence has no give to it. A steel fence like the one Bryson, because he wasn't even in the backyard. The first ball had kicked left and it had settled directly under the fence. It just wasn't in bounds, because it was still, the entire ball was still behind the imaginary line that you would have drawn from post to post.
See, that's where the boundary fence and the post, because like I said, generally it's from white post to white post. Well, on that fence, it's a black fence. So the two bigger posts are here, but for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's kind of like, I'm trying to think of the best way to find it. It's almost kind of like jail bars in a sense, where there's like bars in between, but they're at different depths. So for example, a normal fence could be a couple inches wide, but if you're going for the whole base of the fence from the front of the post to the back of the, like the smaller posts that are in between the two big posts, it's probably about about 4 inches?
Yeah, or something
so.
Like that.
So then all of a sudden, that's when you get into the discrepancy of, you draw the imaginary line. Well, how big is the line? And then is it from those boundary posts, or is it from the boundary fence? And then that's when you're having to get more into the rules. And like I said, sometimes it kind of depends on where you're playing. I need to read directly into the USGA rules to figure out exactly what that situation would be. But the technical rule is, if any part of the ball is touching the line, essentially all the golf ball has to be out of bounds for it to be out of bounds technically.
Yes.
So if any little bit of that ball was technically on the line, he would have been able to claim that it was in bounds. He would have had to try to hit it on the other side or take an unplayable, whatever it may be. Would have been a lot better than stroke and distance like he had to do.
Well, what he was saying he wanted to do, he told the rules official he was wanting to hop the fence and hit it from the other side. So I'm assuming what he was going to do was just throw a club at it, break the club, let go of it so he doesn't break his wrist, break the club, advance the ball maybe 10, 20 yards, and then try to pitch up and get up and down. That's what he was going to try to do. Of course, the second rules official told him, sorry, your ball's out of bounds. You can't do that.
Well, so. And another thing about this, too, that's not good is that Bryson's notorious for playing slow, and then all of a sudden you bring three rules officials in, or how many ever it is, and that slows everything up. So then this adds more back to it, and you mentioned this just a second ago, him last week saying the cameraman hurting his brand or whatever. Whenever you're a top five player in the world, you better at a sport, you better expect to have some cameras on you in 2020.
Right. He's worried about his brand, and Brooks Koepka this last week, he's got a big, you know, big chew of Kodiak he's putting a dip in while he's on the middle. It's like, Bryson, quit worrying so much about your brand, dude.
Yeah, dude.
We just want to watch you hit bombs and not be an ass. If you'll not be an ass, you'll be the most popular guy on tour, because you're hitting bombs and everybody's loving it.
Exactly. And I mean, it's basically what we've summed up here from that Friday DeChambeau to Sunday with Rahm is that, and these rules of golf are the professionals too. I mean, these are the not. I mean, we talk about in other sports like Tom Brady and the Patriots knowing the rules inside and out. These guys are supposed to know every single rule inside and out, and even them, they're having arguments with officials just about, you know, these what. what seem like simple things, but yet they're not, because they're so penalizing and can mean so much in the course of a tournament. Because if you look at someone you mentioned earlier, Schauffele starts off six over. He makes the cut on the number, plays the weekend at what, two under? And
yeah, if you'd have told me at 5 p.m. Thursday Schauffele was going to finish top 15, I'd have been like, whoa.
Well, and that,
something weird happened.
And, you know, my point here is that he played the weekend at only two under and finished T13. It's kind of similar to like the Bay Hill was this year, where you could play around even par on the weekend and still do it. And so, you know, for those guys like a friend of the show, you know, like Taylor Gooch and some of these other guys, Sungjae Im, Paul Casey, Daniel Berger, Kevin Kisner, Joaquin Neiman, these are all these guys that shot four over. They could have done one stroke better. They get to the weekend, all of a sudden, you know, they make this big difference. And then what was the cut line? It ended up being three because Tiger got in. It was almost up to two because there was only few people. The fours even almost looked like they could have got in at one point. But really, at the end of the day, we talk about how much one stroke matters, and that just goes to show right there. All of a sudden, Schauffele makes the cut on the number, better than all those guys we talked about who missed the cut. Shoots two under on the weekend, which at most tournaments isn't good, but is stellar here. Finishes top 15, a lot of FedEx points, a lot of money for him, and so that just goes to show that, you know, these rules have to be consolidated somewhat, because if you're going to use a camera to zoom in on a ball moving half an inch for two strokes, you're costing these guys, you could cost these guys their livelihood at some point.
Yeah, absolutely you could. It's I guess my biggest problem on Friday with Bryson was I thought that once we got the good camera angle, I thought you could clearly see that the ball was out of bounds. I think that, you know, it sucks. I mean, we've all been there where your ball's out of bounds by an inch and it just puts that empty feeling in your stomach. Like, are you kidding me? I've got to take stroke and distance, two shots, and, you know, Bryson, basically the difference in making and missing the cut because my ball's out of bounds by half an inch. Like, that sucks. I get it. But you could clearly see the ball was out of bounds, and I thought that he was trying to manipulate the rule and put pressure on the official to make the ruling in his favor, when I thought you could clearly tell that the ball was out of bounds.
And that's two things to this. One, that's why, I mean, we've seen it before where, was it, I think it was down in Mexico where Justin Thomas had the ruling and the rules official came over. He didn't even know what the hell to do. So we had to get a second official over.
Yeah.
So we have rules officials out there that don't even know the damn rules. And then go back to it. We've talked about this how many ever times. Stroke and distance is just, for it to be a mandatory penalty is just unacceptable. It's just it doesn't make logical sense for an inch difference for him to go back and having to go back and hit it and then make a 10. Just play like a hazard. Two clubs to the nearest point of where it crossed. Drop right there. I don't see what's so bad about that. Or use the same rules of with a hazard. Take it in line with the flag. Obviously, DeChambeau wouldn't have been able to do that because he'd go back into the house and he could hit off the roof if they would let him. But, you know, just play out of bounds like a damn hazard. I don't see why stroke and distance, because even if you hit it in a hazard, you have the option to go back and hit it where it was, as like you did hit it out of bounds. Right. You have that option.
Oh, you always have the option to take stroke and distance. Always.
Yeah, you can do it on unplayable as well, too. Always have the option. Yeah. You can do it anytime you want. But for it to be a mandatory penalty is even for the best guys in the world, I think, is just unacceptable, let alone at your club championship or on your weekend round of golf.
Yeah, it's always seemed odd to me, you know, like hole number 11 at the greens. There's water on the right. There's out of bounds on the left. You don't hit the fairway, you're probably in a penalty area. But if you push it, you get to drop 110 yards from the green, hitting your third, still have a good chance to make par. If you pull it, you're now hitting three from the tee box, and you've got to hit that same fairway again. It's always seemed odd to me, you know, you push it, you miss it right, okay, you can still make par. You pull it, out of bounds left, okay, now you're really going to be fighting to make double. So just always have thought that was a weird
rule. They tried to implement that, the new local rule or whatever it is, where you can
drop in the fairway.
But yeah, at the same time, it's still a local rule, though, and it's not, it has to be implied by the rules committee. It's essentially like if a course has shrubbery or trees with posts in them, a local rule is normally you get to drop away from the post.
Even our MGA tournaments at the greens, we're not allowed to play the new out of bounds rule. It has to be stroke and distance.
Yeah, model local rule E-5 for two penalty strokes may take relief by dropping the original ball or another ball in its relief area, which is essentially kind of like you were talking about, somewhere along the lines of two club lengths from where it...
I think the rule is you can go two club lengths from the edge of the fairway and you can drop it in the fairway hitting four.
Okay.
Parallel to where your ball was. Here it is right here.
If the local rule is in effect, you can still take stroke and distance relief, but now have the following additional option that comes with a penalty of two strokes. One, determining spot. One, you determine where the ball went out of bounds, so just like you would with a hazard.
Yep.
And then you find the nearest fairway edge, no closer to the hole, and then drop the ball in the shaded area. So essentially what it is that is defined by one side of the line from the hole through the point A and the other side of the line through the hole through point B and not near the hole. The relief area is extended by both sides by two club lengths. So essentially what it is that you take the line from where it crossed out of bounds, you find the point no closer to the hole that's in the fairway, on the edge of the fairway. You create a triangle, essentially, that points to the flag in that, and then you can extend it back to as far as you want. There's a diagram for you right there, Colby.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying? So it creates, you find the point of entry, you find the point on the nearest side of the fairway, point
to the
triangle.
Could they even make the new rule more complicated?
That's what I'm saying, yeah. It's like, just let them use two damn club links. What is, or it's so stupid.
Why are we making the rules brain surgery?
It doesn't need to be. We need an overhaul. The rules of golf
simplify
need to make
the game.
We have to, and that's what we're starting to see it even more with these last two big rulings, the DeChambeau and now the John Rahm one. The Rahm one irritates me the most because, I mean, seriously, this happened so many times throughout the week, and now we're going to penalize the guy that wins because he hits one of the greatest shots of the week, probably of the year, and then the Bryson rule because he's such a well-known figure now because he's hitting bombs and because he gets into it with the rules official because the rules aren't clear. It's just something needs to happen. Truly does.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So rule number one, by the way, is when Tiger plays, we watch. That's rule number one. I saw nearly every shot that Tiger hit this week. Saturday was the only day I had a tournament out at the green, so wasn't watching Saturday morning. But I saw nearly every shot he hit the other 3 days. And aside from Friday, when his back was clearly bothering him, he was, you know, couldn't hang on to the club when he finished, blowing everything way right. He was
a lot lower ball speed.
Lower ball speed, lower ball flight. He was hurting on Friday. Other than that, thought he swung it pretty well. Short game was rusty. Putter was rusty. Some four-footers that he tried to hammer in on real fast greens that caught the lip and missed. Definitely some rust there, but it was good to see him play all four rounds, and it was really good to see that Friday was just a bad day for the back, and it wasn't like a lingering issue. He swung it better on Saturday and Sunday than he did on Friday.
Yeah, that's very true, and he was able to get it loose, and it's not something like for example, at the Genesis where we could – his bad play just kept going. And while he went 71-76, then he went 71-76 again. The course obviously got tougher, and plus four was – 76 was, I think, technically below the scoring average yesterday because I think it was 76 point something.
Yeah, I think it was like 76.2.
Yeah, so technically like he shot better than the scoring average yesterday. So he played better on the weekend than a lot of people.
And it still wasn't the ball striking yesterday. The putter in the short game got him in trouble again on Sunday.
And that's the main difference between what Tiger used to be and what he is now is that the putter, because even when he won the 2019 Masters, he was just flushing every iron and hitting a dickie almost every hole. He had so much control over his putter.
Did he finish DFL at that Masters in strokes gained putting of guys who made the cut?
He was down there for sure.
He was bottom five, I think.
Yeah, he definitely didn't win the tournament because of his putter. Let's put it that way. And I think that is kind of what has been his kryptonite. And one thing we talked about in our previous show that I thought was made evident yesterday with his interview with Amanda Baliones was that he talked about the process and getting his feet wet and how it was nice to get out there and play again, which iterated to what we talked about, how he believes in the process and how, I mean, if his back hadn't messed up on Friday, he might have gotten contention and might have felt a little differently. But from the way he talked like he was just getting out there just to play and get warmed up, and he didn't really see himself winning, which is, I mean, obviously, I think he tees up to win every week, but deep down subconsciously, I don't think he truly believed that he had what it took because he hadn't played.
Yeah, he was 2-under through 3 on Thursday, and you start to get those butterflies in your stomach, oh, here we go, and then it kind of went the other direction, obviously, and he ended up making 25-footer or something on 18 to get it in at 1-under on Thursday, so you still feel pretty good. The 1-under on Saturday was a really good round when the scoring average was about 74, I think, so Saturday's round was really nice as he got out there in the morning. So the question now becomes, we got the 3M this week, And then Memphis, WGC FedEx, very next week is Harding Park. Do you think we see him at Memphis to get more tournament reps before he heads out to San Francisco?
It's a good question. I am going to say we don't see him at WGC. If I was going to go off logic reasons, just mainly because normally he doesn't play the week before a major, so that would lead into it. He's played a couple times the week before, whenever it was at Firestone and the PGA was the next week. I would think that because it's still being in Memphis and the PGA at Harding Park, he's traveling a little further than halfway across the country to get over to San Francisco. So I would assume that he would probably spend most of his next few weeks in San Francisco, or at least the next couple weeks out there, to try to get used to everything, because the conditions will be different too as they would be at Memphis compared to Harding Park. So if I was going to be a betting man, I would bet on him not playing the WGC, and the next time we see him being the PGA Championship, is that what's best for his game and for his outlook for the PGA Championship? I would say probably so. I don't know if him playing four rounds in Memphis is going to really give him much benefit at a chance to win at Harding Park. Yeah, I don't know.
It's tough. It's a battle of, you know, can the body take that? Does the body need to play, this week and then take 2 weeks off before he plays another competitive tournament? You don't really know. He's going to be playing a lot more tournaments once August, September, October, November roll around. Obviously, PGA Championship, the FedEx Cup playoffs, which he will be a part of. Don't know if he's going to make East Lake. Might have to do a little bit between now and then, but he does have a win this season. Remember, Zozo was part of this season.
The only player over the age of 40 to win this year, may I say. They stated that yesterday.
Yeah, so. Only once. That's pretty cool. And then he'll have, so what we say, the playoffs. He'll have the U.S. Open.
The Masters in November.
The Masters in November. The Asian swing in October is actually probably going to become the California swing. Zozo, there's another couple events played in Asia that they're looking to move to potentially Sherwood, maybe LA Country Club out in California. So, Tiger's had just a little bit of success in the state of California in his career. So you would imagine he'll play maybe one or two of those, at least maybe try to defend at the Zozo if it gets moved to Sherwood or LA Country Club or something. So we'll see. He's going to be playing a lot of golf. I also would not expect him to play at Memphis. I think it'll be a nice treat for all of us if he does. Obviously, no cut, so you know you're getting four rounds in if you go to Memphis, but we'll see what he decides to do there. Looking at our picks from last week, my streak of betting on the winner was broken. For some reason, my moronic self last Wednesday, I decided not to bet John Rahm at 22-1. I bet Hideki at 25-1. You know, got to get those extra $30 on a $10 bet. What a moron I am for not betting John Rahm, who's now the number one player in the world, at 22-1. I can't believe I didn't make that bet, but my streak is broken. Our one and done podcast, or our one and done poll here on the podcast, you had Cantlay, who got to 7-under on Saturday and then slammed on the brakes, threw the car in reverse, and sped off in the other direction.
And not surprising. Doesn't surprise me one bit at all.
T32.
I admit, it is what it is. When you're playing a course that's this difficult and the conditions like they are, anything can happen. You just can become a snowball effect. So it doesn't surprise me. It is what it is. And really, unless you're getting someone who's in the top five at some point, you're really not going to make much of a move. And of the guys who did finish in the top five, I mean, Fitzpatrick was a good name because we talked about him with Bones. And then obviously, we talked about Rahm all this much. He wasn't him now. Being the number one player in the world, number two is someone who I wanted to save for a major championship, so I wouldn't have used him. So the other guys we talked about don't have any confidence in Jason Day, close personal friend Matt Wallace, who I really liked at 7,000 on DraftKings, but still wouldn't have picked him in a one and done pool. So these are just some of the other guys. Then the other guys who finished T6, Mackenzie Hughes and Henrik Norlander, a couple guys who kind of came in under the radar who we didn't really see. Mackenzie Hughes played a little bit of good golf, but at the same time, not really one of those names. And his strength of field, that was the highest of any regular tour event. These aren't names that you expected to be.
You're not running out Henrik Norlander in a field with an 8-10 field strength.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, everybody who finished, let's see, two over or better did make six figures this week. The two overs were Steve Stricker, Justin Thomas, Siwoo Kim, and Patrick Rogers. Under that, you had less money being passed out. So Patrick Cantlay got you $52,000 at 51,925. We'll round up to $52,000. Patrick Cantlay got you in our podcast one and done. You use Shoffley in our big season long one and done, who actually did really well to get you 171,000 with his T13. So that was nice for Shoffley.
That is the biggest backdoor top 15 you'll ever see.
Yes. Good for him.
A lot of FedEx points, a lot of money too. He doesn't need the FedEx points, definitely. But yeah, definitely. I mean, and he only shot 200 in the weekend, which still just, it baffles me too.
So. Yeah, absolutely. So I used Rose in both pools. Had a good feeling about him bouncing back after the missed cut. I was wrong. Missed the cut by a shot. I think he was one of those at 4 over. Maybe he's 5 over because he was on the cut line. I think he was 3 over going into his last hole, and I believe he made
Rose,
double.
Yeah, Rose was 5 over. Yes, yeah, sir.
He was 3 over going into his last hole, which was the 9th on Friday.
Hit in the water.
Hit in the water. Wears me out. So anyway, missed cuts for me in both. I had 5 made cuts on my ideal DraftKings lineup, but did not place because I didn't have anybody near the top. I had Tiger. I had Koepka. And what's the worst is we were talking about our ideal DraftKings lineups last week, and if I would have spent $200 less to get Stricker instead of Sink, which would have been a higher finish, then I could have afforded Rahm instead of Koepka. Obviously would have been in pretty good position there, but those are the breaks. It's always easy to pick the right guys after the tournament's been played.
Yeah, it is. And something that we didn't talk about, who I had on my ideal DraftKings lineup, I did have Rahm. My only miscut was Teddy Gooch, who missed by 1, almost was able to get it done.
That was my miscut as well.
Had a bad Thursday. So we both were 5 out of 6, but someone we didn't talk about who we both had, Rory shot a nice little 78 on Sunday. After his 8 on the, what was it, 5 or 7?
I think it was 5 when he made the triple. And he made a 15-footer for triple?
It was a long putt. It was,
It was in the 15-foot range.
11 foot 6 inches. Yeah, I thought it was
about a 15-footer. Yeah.
I mean, he was across it, then hit it over, then chipped it long, and it was a complete shit show. And shot 78 and was 1 under through 4. Let's just throw that out there. Yeah. So, we've talked about in the past, Rory and his Sunday woes is... Did he just get out of it and lose motivation? Or, I mean, you know, what was the factor? And there's a lot of other guys who did it, too. Like we mentioned, Cantlay shot the 79. Danny Willett tied him at T32 with an 82 yesterday. Guy who was up there, Lucas Glover, shot 78. And there was just so many high scores yesterday. Victor Hovland, who we talked about, how in the world is this guy the same betting odds as Rahm and better than Hideki and these other guys? He shoots 77, 79 on the weekend and finished T48.
Your dad went ahead and had me put a little coin on Victor Hovland after the second round. He really liked where Hovland stood at 4 under through 2 rounds, and that's another guy who threw the car in reverse and sped off going the other direction.
Boy, yeah, he did. And it's just so interesting because we don't see this a whole lot because, like we had mentioned, they were tearing up the course. They literally had no regard for how the greens kept.
Oh, they said they didn't care if they died on Sunday because they're taking them out anyway.
No, they're mowing them as short as they can, getting them burnt up, like I said, putting the pins. They're just as hard as this concrete out here. The only way you could stop it was after the fact of... After the storm, you were either into the wind or a little bit of moisture got on them, like Finau's on that one hole where Phil putted and was able to hold it. But other than that, you couldn't hold these greens, and it's something that we don't see often besides the U.S. Open, where things can sometimes even get out of hand. So from a viewership standpoint, it was very interesting. We talked about earlier in our preview show how I hoped one of these guys didn't go out and just dominate and win by 5 or 6, which is what happened with Rahm.
Sunday is actually kind of boring.
It was. The front nine especially, there was that little stretch, and even then I didn't think that Rahm was going to blow it.
No, just I didn't either.
If it was, and no, if Ryan Palmer's a hell of a player, but the fact that he went back home to get a putter and then had played so bad the week before, was tinkering with his swing, had not made the same swing and putts in competition coming down the stretch to win a tournament very recently, so I didn't really feel like he had what it took to birdie the last few holes to put the pressure on him. Had it have been a Rory or a
JT, Patrick Reed,
even Shoffley, or even someone who we talk crap on a lot, Spieth or Fowler, one of those guys, it would have been, you know, you would have thought, oh, okay, this could have been something, but... I thought Rahm had it in the bag, and then obviously after his greatest bogey of all time on 16, gets him his 3-shot win. So while it was on the opposite side of kind of what we were looking for, kind of prognosticated in a sense, course was playing tough. One of these great players in the world just went out and played better than everyone else did, essentially. I mean, that's just the bottom line of it. It's not that... It's not that Rahm got the better end of the breaks. It wasn't like a British Open where he got the better end of the wind factor. There was the guys in the Thursday morning wave who got a little bit of the wind conditions, but it wasn't like it was handed to him. And he won by, like I said, 3. He won by 5 shots, and it's... He's now number one player in the world. We mentioned in our previous show about Webb Simpson had a chance to become number one player in the world.
I mean, the winner got 76 points, which is a record for a regular season event. 76 points, that's... And by the way, John Rahm, I mean, if you want to get into the debate about who's actually the best player in the world right now, is it John Rahm? I don't necessarily know. I mean, you look at the PGA Championship in a few weeks, I'll still have Rory handicapped ahead of him. I'll still have Bryson and JT handicapped ahead of him. I'll probably have Webb handicapped ahead of him.
I don't know about that, man. I know Rahm had these last bad couple weeks, but he talked about some things that he was working on in his swing, and I from what I saw, he got it figured out. And so the average points on the World Golf Ranking, he's now essentially 0.5 ahead of Rory, and then JT's down at 3 at 7.5. Rory's at 8.5, and Rahm's at 9.1. So there's a little bit of discrepancy there.
I just still need to see him doing a major. You know, he's been a little disappointing in majors over the last couple of years.
He has. He's been up there in some. A lot of them he's been lackluster. So I see where you're coming from there. I don't know if he's won in California. He won at Torrey. I'm not sure if Harding Park's, of course, necessarily sets up for him. For example, Rory has won there. He won the match play there. Tiger's won there. Maritimes. A lot of these guys played on the President's Cup team when it was there. So we'll prognosticate that a lot going forward. But I think you're undervaluing Rahm here because, like we had mentioned before, even before the break, hadn't finished outside the top 17 once in a calendar year. I mean, it's hard to do that no matter what tour you're playing on.
Yeah, he's a great player. It just feels weird for me to have a zero-time major champion as number one in the world. It just like it felt weird for me, you know, back when Lee Westwood and Luke Donald took over number one in the world. It just, and obviously, it's not that those guys don't deserve it. John Rahm deserves to be number one in the world. Well, a lot of consistency and then a big win in the strongest field that we've ever seen in a regular season event. He deserves to be number one. It's just for me personally, it still feels weird the fact that he really doesn't have a ton of major success, but he's won all these other tournaments and a lot of top fives, and now he's number one player in the world over guys like Koepka and Rory with multiple majors to their credit. JT, who's been so great and has a major to his credit. It's not that he doesn't deserve it, just still feels a little weird to me.
I understand. And, you know, we go back and you mentioned Lee Westwood and Luke Donald. The difference in these, I think, is Rahm's, 25 or 4 years old, maybe even younger?
25, yeah.
25. And Westwood was low 40s, upper 30s when he got it. Donald was, I think, mid-30s. Yeah. So that's kind of the difference in these guys. These guys have been out there for a while, and Rahm is just kind of, in a sense, getting his feet wet out there on the tour. And last year in the majors, he missed the cut at the PGA, which was at Bethpage. But other than that, he didn't finish outside of 11th in the other three majors. So, I mean, he's got finished third at the U.S. Open, finished ninth at the Masters, finished 11th at the Open Championship. So kind of getting up there, has a little bit of experience and starting to figure it out a little bit in the majors. I understand where you're coming from on some of your picks. I think Rory's had his Sunday woes, but he would definitely be up there as contender. JT, Bryson been playing so well. Webb had the chance to be number one in the world. So you have a lot of guys up there. When we talk about who is the best in the world, I really just think it is on a week-to-week basis anymore.
Yeah, because there's so many guys who, when they're at their best, I mean, they just take it crazy low. That's like DJ. DJ has not been the model of consistency. Over the last year, DJ hasn't been great. And then what's he do at Travelers a few weeks ago? I mean, he just comes out and plays great. I mean, great, phenomenal golf. So we'll see.
Got him a putter in the bag that he liked. You know, yeah. He changed three putters in 3 weeks, found him something. It worked. It didn't work this last week.
He didn't break 80 this week.
Yeah, shot 16 over for his two rounds. They didn't let him come back for the weekend.
80-80. I don't think they let him on property to spectate for the weekend.
No, they probably wouldn't. He probably wouldn't want to go out anyway after that. So, but you're just going back on that, yeah, it's just who is the best in the world. It really is on a week-to-week basis now, and it depends on what course you're playing too. Does a course suit a player's eye different than another one? And we mentioned Jason Day how many ever times. He was one of these guys that we thought about, and he's 44th in the world now, just scrolled through on my computer. So it's just such a fickle game, and it really is going to be a week-to-week basis on who is the best player in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Great stuff today. Great tournament this week. I don't think the Memorial disappointed. It was, you know, a little boring on Sunday after what we had last week with the fireworks and the playoff with JT and Morikawa, but, you know, course didn't disappoint. The tournament didn't disappoint. Jack, great as always. So another good tournament this week at the Memorial. 3M Open. We'll preview that. That'll be coming your way Wednesday morning. Not an 8-10 strength of field this week.
No, won't have as good a field as we had last week, but we will have our preview show on Wednesday, and we'll have a lot of good value picks like we had this last week, and we'll be able to find some of those guys, because like this last week, we had 50 guys who could end up winning this tournament, and while any of these guys in this field can win, it's not as many top players in the field. Your favorite boy, Tommy Goldenlocks Fleetwood, is playing his first tournament back.
Fairway Jesus.
So he'll be someone to look at, and we'll preview some of those other guys as well. And so be looking out for that on Wednesday. And then make sure to call down at Bushman and get signed up if you know any juniors who wants to get their game in gear, sign them up for their junior camp starting next Monday.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be a lot of fun. Enjoyed this today. Enjoyed the tournament this weekend. Everybody, enjoy your golf. Make sure that if your ball oscillates, you call a penalty on yourself. Make sure we've got some cameras out to catch people at their local muni breaking the rules. So good stuff. Thanks for listening once again. We're back Wednesday with more 73rd Hole.